Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome to episode 80 of the Rex Chapman Show with my super dope homeboy from the Lextown, Josh Hopkins. What's up, Josh? Episode 80.
Wow. Who you got for 80?
Jerry Rice. Jerry Rice is the most famous 80 I can think of. You?
It's a slew of wide receivers.
Yeah.
You got Chris Carter, Steve Largent, James Lofton, Isaac Bruce from The Greatest Show on Turf.
80.
What about, we tend to talk about, book club here and things we've read all week. Did you read anything this week?
Not a damn thing. Nothing. Did you?
No, that's been book club.
Josh, I want to get right to our next guest because he's just a great guy. Just a wealth of knowledge, sports. Yep. Everybody knows this guy.
He needs no introduction.
So I'm going to get straight to it. We have today my main, Kenny Main, Kenneth Wheelock Main the Third. Welcome, Kenny.
You know what? If the video screen moves like it just did, and it is right now, we just got a new kitten and loves cords. So right now,
he is
playing with the cord because I was low on power. You know what? You can play with that cord. We're at 87%. We're done with that bullshit.
There we go.
What's the kitten's name?
Walter. It's pretty cute. And I was like Walter. I was an anti-cat person historically, except for the occasions where I'd have a friend who already had a cat and the cat was pretty cool. Then I would make exceptions cat by cat, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But Gretchen, who thinks she's Snow White, we're going to have like a llama in the, I just said the other day, we basically live in a really nice kennel. So we have two dogs, two cats, because Walter joined Willa, the other cat, and Gretchen just insisted that Willa needed a playmate, and there he is playing with the microphone cord. Hopefully he jumps up. He's a little afraid of me, but then he gives in and kind of likes me. Like he shows the affection when he wants to, like all cats do, right?
Yeah, it's called a cat.
An asshole.
And like Gretchen. But no, she's pretty consistent.
Oh, Kenny Main, thanks for doing this, buddy. It's good to see you.
Likewise.
Good to see you, man. Hey, real quick, what's your take on the tournament, the NCAA tournament? We have an unusual Final Four.
Yeah, I just want to see that Kansas State guard keep making assists. That was so fun. The 19 assist game, beating a UNLV player's record, by the way, right? Wait.
Right.
Man, I've watched a ton of it for somebody who doesn't full-time cover sports anymore like I used to. Mm-hmm. But I was not feeling well. You can still hear my voice. Gretchen and I had like the all-time colds, not COVID, but it lasted longer. Good. So hopefully we're
going around. The right.
Yeah, just like persistent cough, but so I was down and fortunately for me, the tournament was just starting. So just kind of, I'm going to sit on the couch, watch a lot of games. But there's just been some incredibly fun, entertaining, down to the wire games like it's supposed to be. But as you say, definitely not the foursome that we expected, but who cares? That's the beauty of it, right?
Absolutely. Where are you, Kenny? You out
this
out
minute?
Yes.
I'm at a table with the best background because here's our cat. Come on, Walter. Come over here.
Come on, Walter.
Wait. He likes dice. He likes to see. Walter, come and shoot dice. Let's go.
That's so UNLV of him.
He seriously, I'm in Connecticut to answer that question. I was being more specific. What room am I in is really what I was looking for.
Right.
I mean, look at that. We have the case back here with a bunch of dishes and china that we met. Here's Walter. He's back.
There's Walter.
Seven hours.
Shooting his dice.
got a little bobcat look to him.
Yeah. He's called a Maine Coon is his brand of cat. And apparently he's going to get bigger, which I wish he wouldn't. I wish he would just stay like this the whole time because he's pretty fun. But you wish that for a lot of things. Like, I love my daughters at the ages they are and what they're doing and what they're into and how mature and the relationship we have now. But I so miss the 3- and 4- and 5-year-old version. Like, there was just something so simple about it. And it's funny because at that time in your life, you think things are really complicated. All the new things. Oh my God, they're going to go to kindergarten. How's that going to happen? You know?
Yeah.
But as it turns out, each thing you face, right? These are obstacles that aren't as insurmountable as they seem as you face them. That's true with a lot of things, right? Once you once you live through the thing that seems so daunting, it's not so.
Experience, man.
Yeah,
experience.
For sure.
Reps.
So hey, further answer to that question, we have 4 daughters together, Gretchen and I. Uh-huh. So we each had 2 coming in. So the last of our 4 is still in high school. The rest are either past college, in college, or one's considering where she's going to college. She's got another year of high school after this.
I remember Kevin McHale telling me one time he had older kids than mine. And mine sound like they may be a little older than yours. You've got one still in high school. Isn't it just, he said, Rex, man, kids are great. He said, the thing I didn't realize though, I loved them when they were little and playing with them and all that. But man, it's super rewarding getting to know them as adults.
Yeah.
And when he said that at the time, it was something I'd never thought about, of course, you know, knowing your kid as an adult, can't picture him as an adult. And man, wasn't he right?
Oh, it's true. And you also, you're still supportive in the same way. They're still your little kid, that cliche, and it's true. But you just love the exploration. They're like, whoa, you're doing that. I wasn't as good as what Riley, my oldest one, is doing now at age 23. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
She's already down the road into what she wants to do in a far greater way than I was. My first job was to pull apart. Here's Walter's making an appearance. He might just steal the show. He's pretty cool.
There he is.
We'll just occasionally interrupt for a Walter moment. But okay. My first job was for KSTW, Seattle, Tacoma, an hour ahead of the rest. That was our motto because we come to the 10 o'clock news, an hour ahead of the rest, with Charles Johnson, Wendy Mann, Dave Torsha with the weather. And I came in at 7 o'clock, and my job was, this is so long ago, there were computers. I mean, there were computers.
Right.
It was this thing, you know, there was no internet. You know, the internet was 5, 6, 7 years later, some weird military experiment. So in our day, you typed your stories on typewriters. Not everyone even knows what a typewriter is. Same kind of keyboard, right?
Yeah.
And some were electric and some were manual. And you would come out with this 5-way copy paper. And my job was to come in at 7 o'clock and rip the paper apart. And the white one was for the anchor who read it. The pink one was for the producer. The green one was the director. The orange one, I think, was for the teleprompter. I can't remember all the colors, but there were 5 people, right? Director, producer, anchor, and teleprompter. And the teleprompter, you taped the pages together. It was a physical, And so like if they, in the middle of the show, changed the story, whoever was on prompter had a minute to take out the 3 pages in the middle and retape together. And yeah, it was a long time ago. But that's what I did. So I'm saying Riley doing a little more serious work at my age than pulling apart 5-way copy paper.
Yeah, that's Josh and I. Josh is good friends with my son, oldest child, Zeke, who's 30. And we all actually lived together for a while. And it was fun getting to know Zeke around another friend of mine like Josh. And the great part was Josh and I would come in talking about something one day and my son would go, that's not right. You guys, that's not right. And we go, yeah, we are. And we'd look it up. No, we weren't right. Had no idea. And he's 25 and telling us what's going on.
Correcting you. Well, we're corrected all the time about what you can say and what you can't say. And you know, they think they're cooler than us.
Right.
And they probably are. But I'll tell you, when you were starting to go there, I thought, I've always liked how my daughters felt comfortable around my good friends, like an adopted uncle, almost, right? You know, like, and and appreciated that they appreciated why I liked that person, why they were important in my life. And it gave them this, you know, extra sense of family, like extended family. You got one more person to count on. So I think, you know, we should all be thankful for those relationships.
No question. And whenever anybody says that, I automatically think of Josh, because I was living at Josh's place several years ago, going through a tough time, homeless, living on Josh's couch. And my daughter, my middle daughter, Tatum, came to stay with us during the summer. She was still in high school, came to stay with us for two or three months. It was great. She got over there and wakes up one morning. Her uncle Josh, not really her uncle Josh, had paid for her to go to, she'd been dying to go to acting classes, and paid for her to go to acting classes all summer.
It was the groundlings.
Like comedy. Just beautiful stuff.
Well, hey, Kenny, I remember you telling me this story without naming him, I think, when you were on my podcast.
Right.
And I talked about that roughest period of your life and like, how the hell did you get through it? And he said, I needed some help.
That's right.
There's your guy.
That's my guy. That's
exactly. Kenny, let me ask you something, because I've always been a huge fan. This is a big thrill for me, because you don't often see someone who's completely original. And the stuff you'd say and do, you know, you'd be watching Sports Center and you'd, you know, but be doing something, you'd be like, what did he just say? Because you weren't like a guy that was, you're obviously so dry. You're like, they should call you Prohibition. You were like, you would just, you know, most guys would be up there. They'd be like, oh, he smacks one, cowabunga, you know, whatever. And you were there like, and he hits that really hard. You know, like, he's tall. That one, I love that. You know, a rebound, he's tall, puts it back. And you're just like, this is how did you hit that one day and go, that's my thing? Or your whole life, were you kind of like in fifth grade being like, it's Miss Jenkins, she's dedicated her entire life to education? You know, like, when did that come about?
Fifth grade was Mr. Bell, and he was ex-military. Mark Sansever, my best friend, and I spent most of fifth grade in the hall, actually. So I've always said what I ended up doing for work and still do is the same thing that got me thrown out in the hall in grade school, right? Like, you're in a situation, something happens, somebody says something, and you have like that nanosecond, what's the funniest, most absurd thing right now that I can spit out, right? That will own the room. Like that, yeah, I was a ham and probably continued to be. I don't know. I think you're shaped by everything, right? Like, we've all talked about this. You know, my dad was a funny guy. My uncle Gordy was very funny. My dad's friend, Al Drake, I stayed up watching Johnny Carson. You know, that was a big deal to stay up for the monologue at 11:30. The Bugs Bunny hour for certain shaped me. Get Smart, you know, just other funny things. Like, I wasn't copying, but it definitely influenced me. And then, you know, with time, I don't think I put on an act. I think you're getting right now what you got on TV, except I don't have makeup and no tie and don't have to worry about, you know, total rebounds or whatever. Right. So there's fewer restrictions than there once were. But no, I think it was always, like you're saying, like, here's a situation. Guy hits a home run. What can you say that's different than he hit a home run? That's boring. You got to do better than that. Cowabunga is not that great. I'm not going to do that. You know what I mean? So I think what I would do oftentimes is in my off time, just driving down the road or out playing golf or sitting at home, something on TV. And I would just scribble down, like, here's a good line to use one day. And I had this list of, you know, like Eddie Vedder's notebook he brings on stage, not saying I'm, you know, comparing myself to Eddie Vedder, but that's what it reminds me of. Like, oh, I want this handy because I want to be able to say roll one, light one when an NBA play, like marijuana reference, when a guy hits a three, you know, put one in the air. Like, I mean, there's
isn't
just
that
all these...
great though? Isn't that a great outlet though, Kenny? I mean, to 100%. Be playing golf and then, because a lot of people think funny things. I would think they do, but you had an avenue to let it out. And you know, 100%. you had a stage every single night.
Yeah. And I will readily admit I miss that hour for sure. I love what I'm doing now. I'm doing stuff for Caesars, doing a podcast, always pitching other ideas, commercials, this and that. But definitely there's no comparing that hour, that live hour, the danger of it. the immediacy of it, the adrenaline of it. I still remember one of my favorite, there are many, many, but right toward the end, I think it was like a month before I left. And it's almost been 2 years now since I left ESPN. There was just a truckload of no hitters. You remember the 21 season?
Yeah.
And this is the beginning of the season. I think there were seven no hitters in the first 2 months or whatever the hell it was. And so one night with 1 minute before we're coming on the air, the no hitter gets completed, whatever the hell game it was. Right. And in that next, now we're down to 55 seconds. Now we're down to 45. And this guy, Evan, the producer in our ear, here's what we're going to do. If he comes to the interview, we're doing the interview right out of the gate after one shot. If he doesn't come to the interview, we're going to do this. And really, you know, he gives us like seven things that might happen. Now we're down to 10 seconds and we still don't know which one's going to go because we don't know if this or that is going to happen. Right. But we have all these contingencies and we have the faith in each other and the trust that he's not going to hang us out. Right. He's not going to stick you on camera. You know, you're not going to do that. So that part is hard to replace. Like I said, the danger of live TV and the adrenaline rush of that's just happened. And now you're talking about it. Now you're going to drop that great line that, you know, you wrote on the golf course 3 days ago. Like, so yeah, that part's missed, but I like all the rest of the stuff I still get to do.
That is so similar to, you know, a lot of comedians' process. They just think things and they write it down and then they kind of think of a way to workshop it in, you know, to something, but you kind of did it on the fly. Did you have a like a sports center guy that you felt like was your best straight man or your chemistry guy with? Like, did you have one? And also, did you always just lay these out and they didn't know they were coming? Like, did you save these for yourself or like in a meeting before, did you think, hey, I might say he's tall?
Oh, no, you'd never tell them before.
Okay, all right.
Right, right.
And in fact, that's what I wanted to hear.
I think a lot of people do this in other forms where, like on feature stories, when we went out and did the NFL stories for years, we did the fake NFL stories. Mm-hmm. We sometimes, because we'd get, you know, we'd come back, we think it's the funniest thing ever, and the boss is like, I don't know if everybody's going to get this one, blah, blah, blah. And they take it, you know, and maybe they're right, but I was always like, who cares if everybody, you don't want everybody
to get it. Yeah.
You want some people. So what we would end up doing is sometimes putting in a line that we didn't even care if it made it or didn't make it. Just something outrageous, you know, we can't run this. Okay. You win. And then, but they'd leave the other stuff that we really wanted.
Right.
We pulled that once or twice. But to answer the earlier question, I hate naming names because I liked just about everybody. You know, there was really nobody that I had some big, I don't know, like didn't mesh with, you know, but instead of the best straight man, I always liked the person who made me giggle, you know, got me even looser than I was going to. Buchagras is in that category. John Anderson, you know, I mean, the list is long and we got to know each other so well that you could play off each other. Just like with a look, like you knew something, the old twinkle in the eye, something's coming, you know? So,
Well, that's why people love sports and how it revolutionized things because it's art. I mean, to be able to do that on the spot and play with one another, you've got these parameters you're in talking about sports. Walter, hello.
Hello.
You would come up with these things, and that's what made it so much more entertaining than highlights of sport. It's an art, and it's a credit to you that you didn't have people that you got along with better because you were so adaptable.
I think the best shows were always with people that you treated each other like teammates. Keith Olbermann was talking about that when I interviewed Dan Patrick and Keith Olbermann together, and they were both very good to me, but they spoke fondly of each other, like how we both wanted to be good teammates. They certainly had different personalities. Keith's just, you know, the biggest guy in the room, and he's loud, and he, you know, for some he's too much. I think he's great. He's like a, you know, tortured genius. And Dan's, you know, consistent through the years, funny, you know, smart, knows how to pull off a show. Half of it, in my opinion, it's knowing how to make a show matters more than the material you're delivering necessarily, because nobody cares if Keith loves to be an encyclopedia of many things, and he is. It's unbelievable. Like his quick knowledge, I don't have that.
Smart.
But I know how to make a TV show happen. You know, whether I know a damn thing about hockey or whatever the thing is I'm doing, you still know how to make a show work. I still remember the knock on me going way, way back, that job where I was pulling the green sheets apart. Mm-hmm. I eventually got on TV there, right? eventually got interviewed by ESPN, didn't get hired. And I knew the rap on me was he's just not enough of a sports nerd. Pretty good on TV. He's got some good writing. He knows how to pull it off. But, you know, oh my God, what if in the middle of a show we start talking about the Cubs middle relief or what, you know? And they were right, really. So when I finally had my third interview to finally get hired, this is when ESPN2 came around, Vince Doria was the boss. And I said, look, I still don't know who the fifth pitcher on the Cubs is, and I really don't give a damn. But if you tell me to do a story on the son of a bitch, it'll be the best story you got. So I was like, nice. I'm very confident about my writing, about my execution. If you give me a minute to study who the fuck the five pitchers are, it's not to knock having a good base of knowledge. It's obviously beneficial to have, you know, some depth and know a lot about this or that, but it's pretty rare that every anchor can know everything about everything. Like how can, you know, then I bet you're not very good at disseminating it.
Exactly.
If you're that nerdy just to know all the zeros and ones, you might not be able to eloquently and effortlessly do it in the moment live TV.
You were describing the danger for that hour, the anticipation of that hour going on SportsCenter every night or going on TV every night, and the producer and the people in your ear and your cohort. It's teamwork. And Josh and I are constantly, you know, talking about, because we talk to a lot of from everybody from Mike Wilbon on here to athletes, but many broadcasters.
Bob Costas.
I'm always fascinated to know, because like where Josh and I grew up in Kentucky, we didn't have many 10-year-olds that said, you know, I want to be a broadcaster. Most everybody is saying, you know, I'm going to be a baseball player or a football player. I know you played sports. When did you make the pivot?
I mean, really, it happened when I couldn't go on with what I really wanted to do. I was not going to be Joe Montana. I'm not claiming, you know, like I played at UNLV. I didn't play very much, but it's kind of funny. I was one of those guys, in my opinion anyway, who was getting better over, you know, as I matured. Right. When I was in ninth grade, I was 5'8", 130 pounds. And I played fifth quarter. Like they would hold the regular four quarters, then they'd have this extra legal fifth quarter for the shitty players who didn't get in the four quarters, right?
It should have been your nickname, Kenny. Fifth quarter, man. No,
but I was pissed. I was like, fuck this. I'm better. I should be in the first four. I was a better thrower than the other guy. He was a better athlete for certain. Bruce Humphreys, he's a lifelong friend. But he wasn't a quarterback. He couldn't throw. He could play 100 other things. Great at basketball, great at baseball.
He sounds soft.
No, not soft.
Bruce sounds soft.
I got all the data on this. I'm talking more about ninth grade football than I am near a question, but it goes back to it, right? And it also is a good story of perseverance. So I would come in for the fifth quarter and I was humiliated, pissed off. What the fuck am I out here? The fifth quarter, this game doesn't even count. Only my dad and Mr. Mihawk are staying around to watch. Cheerleaders are over. They're not paying attention. Like, just awful, right? The next year, I'm still like 5'8", 140 pounds or whatever, right? And then over one summer, going into my junior year, I became 6'2", 140 pounds. You're right. Just straight up, right? So my point is, I was kind of a late developer, and then I went to junior college and ended up at UNLV. So the kid who played ahead of me, Sam King at UNLV, went or had a chance to go to the Seahawks. He led the nation in total passing yards that year in 1981. And my coach, Tony Knapp, said, hey, to the Seahawks, hey, if you like Sam, you should look at this other guy, because Sam was going to do something else, go to Canada or whatever. And I got to go throw and signed a contract that day. I was probably strike insurance, if you really want to break it down, because 82, there was
a
strike.
Right.
But I could throw better than the other rookies, at least in my opinion. I wasn't going to beat out Jim Zorn on day one. Dave Craig was number two. Sam Atkins was number three. I was just hoping to stay around long enough through preseason to either hide me on the taxi squad or cut me and let me go to the USFL or can't, you know, like I was trying to prolong that, right? Day one in Cheney, Washington, literally day one, I'd worked out with the team in Kirkland for like 3 weeks, doing fine, like feeling, you know, like I said, feeling very comfortable. Like I was fitting in. I was scared. I was nervous because what the hell am I doing here? But I'm throwing to Steve Largent. Like, how bad is that, right?
That's
throwing
so
against Tenney easily, right? And I failed the physical for my ankle because I'd broken it really bad in 1980 at Oregon, UNLV at Oregon. Had a fracture dislocation. They basically were saying, he's not valuable enough to this organization with this injury to keep, you know, he's just going to end up like suing us and getting money out. You know, like I just wasn't worth it. And I get where they were coming from, but it was a total shock. I thought I had already gotten through that process and proven that my ankle's good enough. I'd signed the waiver. I'm not going to sue him if something happens because I came in with the injury, the whole thing. And I wake up that morning, I go to do the Cybex test, and it was like a lie detector sort of. And I always said, like, my ankle had lied. Basically, like my left ankle was up here and the line on my right. If I knew what it was, I would have cheated. I would have gone easy on my good leg, hard on my bad leg, and they would have looked right. But I didn't know. So I went home. I was definitely depressed. Like, I got sick overnight. Like, my body just, like, I can't believe this happened. I got $10 in meal money. $10, $5, $4 ones, and $4 quarters. That's what I made from the NFL. And recovered. And I looked in
literally had a cup of coffee in the NFL.
Yeah. So this is back in the day when people got jobs through newspaper help wanted. If anybody remembers those newspapers.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. And in the newspaper, like a few days later, I was kind of like, all right, what am I doing? I still wanted to play. Like, I went to a couple of USFL tryouts and CFL, just never worked out. It was always like, oh, he throws okay. What's your background? Oh, he ruined his ankle and he got cut, you know. So it didn't work out. But in the newspaper, there was an ad that said, looking for whatever the hell it says, ambitious, you know, young people, you want a career in broadcasting or something, college degree, blah, blah, blah. And I call him up. I got hired over the phone. And 3 days later, I'm pulling green sheets apart or five-way copy paper apart for this little station, Channel 11, Seattle, Tacoma. Took a few years to actually get on TV. I was kind of a background guy, producer, moved up, a writer, did this and that. But that's how it all happened. So when you said, when did you turn? That was kind of it. Like,
that's
I need a job now because it looks like I'm not going to get a chance at this football thing.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Talk about the actual injury. It happened, as I believe, you didn't need to be out there possibly. And exactly how it happened, because it's so devastating. And what it's led to as far as run freely for you.
Yeah. No, I mean, it ends up being a positive story. But we were at Oregon. We got beat. We played a bad game all around. Oregon was pretty good that year, actually. I think they were like 8-3. This is 1980. That's how old I am. So, we're getting, I think the score was like 33-9 or something, if I'm not mistaken. Last play of the game. Why not throw up one? We were not going to win, but you know, same thing, like a losing team in basketball. Don't they fire from half court? Yeah, like try to get three more points.
Yeah. I don't know.
Some guy sticks his helmet on my ankle on the last play. I threw a shitty pass for openers. It was raining. The ball slipped out. Ball goes nowhere, incomplete, and I'm still on the field. Now, in the old days, if you ever look at football film, I think they still do it this way. The last shot is always kind of like a pan of the field left to right, and they go up to the scoreboard, and whoever's watching the film knows the final score. They're making that shot on film, and there's me in the left corner kind of writhing in pain.
Oh, and it's raining. Yeah,
I was in shock at that point, so none of that mattered. But fortunately, a couple people recognized what happened. To their credit, a couple of the Oregon guys stayed with me. Like, they knew that something bad had happened. One of my guys came over. The trainer came running out. They took me to Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene, Oregon, I believe it was. I got those cool hospital pants. Remember when we used to wear those? That was kind of like For some reason, they flew me home to Vegas. The defensive line coach gave me a scotch and water on the airplane. Said, this will help. And that, I mean, total Vegas, right?
This, of course.
And then I had surgery the next day, and it was pretty bad. They were worried, you know, like Look, fracture dislocation is no joke. You tear every ligament. You broke the outside bone. Like, it wasn't good.
Metal pins and stuff.
They put pin across, metal up the side. Yeah. Then they took it out the next, I think it was February, as we were debating, am I going to come back and play? The coaches, to their credit, Coach Knapp was like, hey, we're going to honor your scholarship, finish your degree. And, you know, we don't anticipate you're going to be out playing. You just had this terrible.
Right.
I just kind of got motivated over the summer, went back to Seattle, didn't play spring ball, just, you know, went back to school, was still limping around. And I just like, I'm going to come back. Like, I just said to myself, and I remember being with my family. I think it was June or July. And they were all kind of lamenting, oh, it's too bad he doesn't get to finish. And I just got pissed, got out of the room, and I went and ran like 8 miles. I've never run that far in my life.
Of course.
Stupid. I probably like set my leg back 10 years by doing that. But I, you know, I was like, damn it, I'm going to prove these people wrong. But by the end of the summer, I started throwing. It was definitely stiff. It wasn't normal, but it wasn't hurting. And I could drop back. I could roll out. I could do whatever.
Wow.
And Coach Knapp had me, all he asked me to do is stand on one leg, stand on that leg, stand on that leg. Show me that you can raise up. Like, do you have that kind of control? We ran for a physical fitness test, we would run 5 400s in a row.
Oh,
so the quarterbacks would go, tight ends would go. Quarterback, you know, you trade off your positions, right? I think quarterbacks and tight ends ran together, whatever. The running backs went next, whoever it was. I ended up winning 4 out of my 5 heats. And I just kind of like,
do you remember the number? Do you remember what you ran?
In junior college, I ran 400 in JC just to stay in shape for football. I was slow. I was getting murdered by actual runners who were, you know, in the 47. I was like 51.3, I think was my best.
I'll take
which isn't very fast in
I'll
a
take it.
Track scale, but not bad for
it's real.
A slow quarterback. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that was kind of like in my system somehow. But in any event, I played that one more year. I didn't play that much again. So like I said, Sam King was the starter. A guy named Randall Cunningham, who just turned 60.
Yeah.
He was the freshman. So Randall, everybody always has it wrong. Randall could have come in and started. He was that good. He was unbelievable. But, you know, coach was being like, Sam and Kenny have been here. Sam's the starter. I was second. I think Randall might have ended up redshirting. I don't even remember for sure. But he wasn't going to just jump in. Now, had they needed him, certainly he had the talent to pull it off. But everybody always gets that backwards, which is always funny where I have to – No. He was behind us. And he admits to it. I just saw him at the Super Bowl. It was great to see him. He's a pastor now down in Las Vegas.
Randall Cunningham is 60. That's hard to believe.
I know.
Yeah.
That's hard to believe.
It's not right. But you know what? You started to ask way back about when did you make that decision?
Yeah.
The thing is, I didn't even want to do sports. Like, growing up, my whole emphasis was real news, you know, real journalism, documentaries, political things, took journalism, took English, took a lot of political science. And that was where I really wanted to be headed, right? So when I finally got on TV in Seattle, I didn't even want to, you know, I didn't volunteer to be in sports. I was like wanting to be the Mr. Local Reporter guy and maybe branch into something bigger as time went on. I was every night had to watch the national news back when there wasn't all the cable stuff. You watched Dan Rather before that. Yeah. It was Walter Cronkite, whatever. And we were a Monday through Friday operation. We always joked, if there's news on the weekends, it's news to us. And you guys didn't laugh, but we thought it was funny. Okay, that's fine. Not for everyone. Let me try that again. So we were a Monday through Friday operation. No, anyway, so when they added the Saturday, Sunday, Jack Eddy, the news director, is like, basically, you played football, you're doing sports.
Okay.
All right. I guess. I mean, I didn't really want to. I played sports all my life. I followed sports all my life.
Typecast. Like I said, right away. Typecast.
But I just jumped in, and next thing you know, I'm doing Husky games and Sonic games and the Seahawks and all this stuff that's really fun to go to. And my environment, I'd been through that in my life. You know, it made sense. And then suddenly the city council meetings on, you know, utility rates became less interesting. And so I distinctly remember it was the Joe Montana to John Taylor left to right post to beat the Bengals in the Super Bowl 1989. And I had a pretty good, I just knew that was a good show. Like, for my little station, you know, our little tiny crew, we pulled off a really good 5-minute thing covering the Super Bowl or whatever else we were doing. And I was like, what the hell? I'm just going to send that to ESPN and see what happens. Like, what do I have to lose? And they wrote back or called back, I should say, literally 2 days later. Like, hey, we really liked your tape. Send us another one. We want to see if that was a fluke. So wow. I like scrounge around. All right, what's my second best show? And so I sent him that one. And then I ended up going back for the interview. But this is where it gets into who's the fifth pitcher on the Cubs. I remember John Walsh, the exalted ruler of ESPN. Love John Walsh. He starts literally asking about, I can't even, was it Detroit starting pitching? No, Detroit closers. I said, well, you know, the starters will come in, then there'll be the relief setup man, then the closers will wrap it. I mean, I'm just, what the hell answer is that? What did I just say? Like, then I start lying. I just start making shit up. It's like, why did I do that? He knows way more than I know, and he knows that I don't know what he knows, but he certainly knows that I don't know what I don't. And so I left with, oh, fuck, they're never going to hire me. Like, I just made a fool of myself in this meeting because I failed the PA test, essentially, right? Did pretty well on the air. I went down, did a tryout show, did fine in the regular interview stuff about who you are and your goals, blah, blah. But when it came to who the fuck's the fifth pitcher on the Cup, no shot. Still
no
don't
chance.
Know, and don't care either. But so I think that got put in the minds of a handful of them. Like, oh, he's not bad on TV. He's kind of funny, good writer, but we can't trust him out there on a national show. What if we start talking about the fifth pitcher on the Cubs all of a sudden, you know?
All right.
And then I think I left the TV job in Seattle that I was doing the sports and the news on. And I kind of thought I was something because ESPN's talking to me.
Right, right, right.
I was like, fuck these guys. I'm out of here. So so I quit. I felt great driving down that first road, just the first road. Second road started. What the fuck did I just do? I have no money. I have like $2,000. And I just quit a decent, you know, not great paying, but, you know, a legit
job
in Seattle. Not the smartest move. So I called ESPN and I told them what I had done. I left out some of the details.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're like, yeah, but whatever. People change jobs. Don't keep in touch. You know, they handle it professionally. They don't need to know, and they didn't care.
Yeah.
So now I have no job, and I called the garbage company because I used to be a garbage man during college, and I called this guy Steve Caputo, who's running United Waste in South Seattle. I said, hey, I just quit my TV job. You know, is there any chance, just even for a few months? I'm just trying to get back on my feet, figure out what I'm doing next. And he wanted to help, but the problem was, you know how they used to have the guy that hung on the back?
Yeah.
Called the Swamper. That's what I was back in the day.
Right.
Well, all these garbage trucks had moved to the Claw. They don't need the Swamper guy because they got the machine that just lifts.
Right.
The industry had passed me by in these intervening years.
The sanitation industry.
Yeah.
You didn't recognize it anymore. No.
Yeah, you were a relic.
So he says to me, what I do have, I can help you out for, you know, a little while. We need to make some garbage cans. They come off a train, they get moved over by a truck, and you got to pull them apart and put the wheels on and put the lids on. And so now I just on TV the last Friday night or whatever day it was, like the next Wednesday, I'm in the rain in Kent, Washington, making garbage cans. And no offense to anybody who makes garbage cans for a living, but it wasn't what I wanted. You know what I mean? Like I was just trying to get by. I ran out of fucking cans. I made the cans so zealously. I was trying to like prove my worth to the garbage people to get another shot. I just like burned through, like there's no more left. There's no more to make. So they let me go. And then I looked in the paper again, getting a job through the newspaper. It said something like marketing company, television experience, a bonus, looking for energetic people, blah, blah, blah. I was like, they're talking to me. So I go to this place, the address in there. And it turns out it was a telemarketing company. And they were selling prepaid legal insurance. And I was working for them the next month. I was like, in my head, is like, my mom, who had passed away, she'd be upset if I like took unemployment or did what, like, no, I made these decisions. I quit that TV job. I made the fucking cans too fast. It's time to go do something else. So now I'm selling prepaid legal insurance. And in the middle of doing that for like 6 weeks, Jesse Jones, my good friend who works in Seattle, who was still at the other station, the Channel 11 station, he calls, he says, Kenny, Al fucking Jaffe just called, call him back. Recruitment.
Big deal.
So I call him back and he asks what I'm up to. He knew that I'd left my job. They're just checking in. So I tell him I'm working for a marketing company, which I was, because I didn't tell him about the prepaid logistics marketing, doing some writing. I'm doing some writing and doing some marketing. How are you doing, Al? So he says, all right, great. We want to bring you back for another interview. I was like, what? I'm fucking selling prepaid legal insurance.
Yeah.
And they want to interview me about being on TV. Okay, let's go. So I go back. We have another round of interviews. I can't remember this. I just know it happened. I don't know what happened. I just know it was a friendly. They just wanted to make sure, what are you up to? What's going on? We still like you. Nothing happens. So I quit the prepaid legal insurance industry and I get into the long distance sales industry, which is MCI. Remember when MCI
and
Sprint and what were the, there were a couple others that were all kind of battling for your market, market share. So I'm selling corporate, phone service to these companies in Seattle, and ESPN calls again and they say, we want you to cover the Goodwill Games. This is 1990.
Hey, hey, hey.
So the Goodwill Games was sort of like a poor man's Olympics, right? For those who know or don't know, Russia and the U.S. And this is right after the whole breakup of, so they're trying to do this Goodwill thing. Let's still be friends through athletics. Right. Mm-hmm. And they had me do that in Seattle, but I then, for the 3 years, 3.5 years, I would just bug ESPN like, hey, want to do a story about so-and-so? I could do a feature, So I was always selling them while they would call me occasionally. Hey, Griffey hit 3 home runs. Go interview him. Right. We need it for Baseball Tonight or whatever. I would even do like extra credit. I would like go home and type the story and put that in the envelope with the tape that I was overnighting. Hey, you could have had this, but you chose only, So it took a while, but that's a crazy, that whole period. I call it my blue period.
Yeah, I love it. I absolutely love it. Who was playing basketball at UNLV while you were playing football? Is this Reggie Theus and those guys?
No, he had just left. That was just before. We had Sidney Green,
Sidney Green,
right out of New York. Danny Tarkanian, right? He was a pretty decent guard.
Sure was.
I think my years, it was sort of like they were really good. Then there was this period where they were kind of like NIT good, which again, isn't bad, right? You'd rather be that good as opposed to not that good. But I then leave and then, some years later, a handful of years later, man, they had a nice run. Oof. That whole Larry Johnson and Ogman and all those guys, man, those are some teams. But
Anthony.
It's funny. Oh, yeah. I went to a lot of the games. I wasn't that close to, I bump into him maybe, I think we knew who each other were, but, I hung out with my guys more. I had my friends from football. I kind of had your own little crew that way. And I'm still friends with a bunch of them. We trade notes. It's crazy. And I go back even further. Some people say after they left their high school, they never looked back, like barely talked to anybody there. It's like, man, some of my best friends still are people I knew from fifth grader.
Same.
Kindergarten,
and the same way.
Yeah.
Mark Beach, Mark Sansevier, by the way, Mark Sansevier, I should mention, the one I cited for, helping from develop earlier. My comedy. He broke Babe Ruth's home run record in one summer of wiffle ball. So we played basically from May, April, right? Baseball started in April. We played from April to September. All the time, just all the time.
Yeah.
And, there's back in the day where we had, there's no cell phones. There's no, message machines. You just either get the guy on the phone or you don't. Or in some cases, one guy would swing by on his bike. Hey, man, you want to go? Let's go play. So we'd play 2-on-2, or if we had more than that, two people. We had a really small field, but it was perfect for 2-on-2 or 3-on-3. We had so
many. You go 1-on-1, you can have the ghost runners. You could do it.
You could. Oh,
So we kept stats. We lined the field with chalk or sugar. My sister sang the anthem. We lit up firecrackers. My dad built us, and he wasn't even that handy, but our family, like my grandpa owned a hardware store and could build anything. He could probably wire a house. Like he could do anything, right? My dad could make some things, but you just knew it wasn't as good as his dad. Then after me, I just fell off the table. Like Gretchen has to make everything. If we get something that you have to build, I cheer her on and wish her well and pretend that I'm doing more than I'm doing.
I'm with you. Hey, Kenny, before we let you get out of here.
What do you mean? I thought we were just, this is just.
We are.
We're warming up.
I wish. Hey, talk to us a little bit about Run Free.
Oh, Please. You know what? We bailed on the injury story. I appreciate
the rebrief.
Thank you. So all these many years went by. The injury story, refer to that, shuttle back to 20 minutes, 7 seconds. You'll get that bit. Whatever it was. So ruined my ankle. And then, you know, like through my 20s, I was still playing men's softball. I was even going for runs. Like I, you know, it was, I knew my ankle was kind of, okay, it's not normal, but it's working still. Each decade, worse and worse and worse. And it got to the point, this is not a joke, there was a week in Seattle about 10, 11 years ago. And I was in such pain, day-to-day kind of pain from this. I went to 3 different doctors. One was the fusion guy, you know, where they lock it up. And allegedly that takes the pain away because there's no motion. Next one was the replacement guy. Mm-hmm. And I was like, so if I do this, I can play flag football and this. And no, we wouldn't want you to run. Mm-hmm. I was like, why would I get the surgery then? I can already not run. Why would I, why would I pay money, go through like 17 weeks of therapy and you just want me to walk at the mall? Like what? Yeah. No, you guys are out. And James Andrews people said, don't do it anyway. And the third guy was amputation. And I was dead serious. I was dead serious.
You were that much
day to day waking up depressed. Like, fuck, I have to get on my, I have to stand up now. Mm-hmm. I'd rather just stay in bed another 2, you know. And they saved my life because they were like, dude, you're too young for this. We get that you're in pain. Get a better therapist. Get a brace. There's some other things you can do before you take that extreme of a measure. Mm. So I really appreciate that. That's the kind of advice they gave me. I found some better therapy. A guy named Nino Pribic, which I found him by pure luck. He's still my guy. He's a chiro who just brought it back to life. It was not looking good and it wasn't working. And he taught me how to take care of it better as well. And then I found this brace that was really good, but it wasn't the one I have now. So a few years after that, I ran into this guy in Gig Harbor, Washington, Ryan Blanc. And he makes this device for veterans who were in situations like me where you're literally considering cutting it off. Mm-hmm. And instead of doing that, you put this device on, doesn't fix anything, but it lets you do stuff magically because it takes all the pressure off the joint.
Wow. Right?
It sort of, it displaces the pressure off the bad joint and you're now just along for the ride.
Where does it place it?
What's that?
On another joint. It would take it and put it on another joint.
It basically, it has these, what do you call it in the back? The spokes. No, there's a better name for it. It has like these two bars in the back. So like
stabilizer.
I weigh 2-ish, you know, plus somebody who weighs 300 might need 4 of those things.
Okay.
A young kid absorber. Or a girl who weighs 100 pounds, maybe only needs one of them. And it, I know the name, I'm just spacing out. But you if you look at the website's called Run Freely, RUNFREELY, runfreely.org. Shows a picture of it. And when you see it, you'll get it. You stick your leg and your foot in the device, then you stick the whole device in your shoe, which you buy one size up, right? So it would fit in there. And you're off to the races. I ran on day one on a treadmill and I hadn't run in forever. And I literally like cried for 2 hours. Like I couldn't talk to Gretchen. I couldn't get words out because I was so overwhelmed by this.
I've got to put you in touch with one of my best friends, my high school point guard. We grew up together. Greg Bond had a car accident, avoiding hitting me in a car, bad car wreck, and broke his ankle. He played college ball for my dad for the last 15 years. He has it's been a nightmare with his ankle. And I am definitely going to put you in touch because the last conversation we had, he is at the, I'm talking about getting it fused. It's just not good. So I'm putting you in touch with Greg Bond, Kenny.
Do it after we hang. No, like the minute we hang up,
I will.
And I'll talk to him 2 minutes later if he's free. Great. It's what's been cool about it, among many things, is how many different stories. Everybody has a little different story about why it changed their life. Some went back to work. Some got to walk at the park with their kid. Some of them are just like, dude, now I can get up and I can, you know, go take a trip to the store with my wife. And then it's liberating for all of them.
Yeah.
And it's not like we're big, we're tiny you know, it's me and my Twitter and a girl named Mara and my wife helping. And we don't have a building. We don't have, you know, an endowment. We just, the next guy that sends in $20 is the next $20, you know? So every time we get up to the amount that it costs to buy one of these devices, I call the guy, hey, let's do another one. You know, so it's one by one.
That's
great. Wow. And I got a few things up my sleeve. I won't tell them now because I don't want to put pressure on the people we're talking with until they want to say yes or no. But we got a couple interesting fundraiser ideas. They're so, so sometimes
terrific.
I think of things that are so simple in my mind, and other people make it so complicated.
Yeah.
So I hope a couple of these little things come off.
I do.
They're too. Not your conventional let's have a golf tournament thing, but something different.
Good.
And we'll just keep on making an impact.
Fantastic. Kenny, favorite movie?
It's a three-way tie.
Oh, okay. This is great.
Apocalypse Now, Chinatown. Yes. It's a four-way tie.
Okay.
Ready?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
In no order. Apocalypse Now, Chinatown, The Killing by Stanley Kubrick, and Jerry Maguire.
Oh,
hey,
I love I was going to say Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is right next to it.
Okay.
Adjacent.
That's not a pillow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just how do they know which way we're going? You know, I mean, John Candy's John Candy.
Yeah.
Steve Martin. But there's something about when Kubrick passed away, I remember reading this big story. A.O. Scott, I think, was the writer. And was going through all, you know, and I was no expert on I just knew he was this famous, mm-hmm. you know, talented guy. And I read about The Killing. It's horse race based. It's about the ripping off a racetrack. Mm-hmm. And it's told in non-sequential, I think that's called non-linear, I believe is the term.
I don't think I've ever watched all of it, Kenny. I've got to go back and watch this.
It's black and white. There's a narrator. It's old timey.
Yeah,
it was Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. You know, like the voice describing everything. But it's a little hokey that way, but it's so cool that way. It's of its time. That was probably pretty cool. And showing it out of order, like you see a scene and a minute or two later, you see, wait a minute, I just saw that. But now it's from this angle, from this guy's perspective.
That's
Apocalypse
great.
Now is, I could watch that 1,000 times. It's just
smell so many napalm moments. In the morning.
Yeah.
Front row center for any entertainer, singer, to watch an athletic event, dead or alive. Like you could go back.
I know that I want front row center. I want to be in like a loge box.
Okay.
Corner.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
I love
okay.
people. I don't love crowds all the time. Like the concert experience. Although I will say courtside at a professional game is pretty cool. You think it's going to be weird, and then you realize nobody gives a shit that you're sitting there. But you just have this amazing view. You can hear
front
the
row.
Conversation.
Yeah.
Okay, let's don't completely dissect. Let's let you go point. With
Stevie Wonder.
Stevie Wonder.
I have several. You know, we're in now. We're in stoppage time. Mm. Is there any limit? Is there some ruler of podcasts that says
no?
How dare you go beyond 60 minutes?
No, there's not.
What the hell.
We love it. We're
making trying to up let you our go. Own rules.
I'm going to tell you three Stevie Wonder stories in a row then.
Do it.
Please do. It
starts with back to my TV job in Seattle. I'm finally on TV. This is my first week. They're literally letting me be a news reporter for $9.54 an hour. I am producing and broadcasting for KST Washington an hour ahead of the rest. You ready for this? So day one, I do the conventional, like the garbage dump that has, which by the way, I already have an affiliation with garbage.
Right,
Swamper,
right. You know,
uh-huh. Big Swamper.
Yep. Taking me back. So I'm kind of like one of the most, I'm one of the, what is it? The foremost authority on the garbage industry in the Seattle. So no, it's one of those garbage dumps that's leaking methane gas, right? Doesn't it happen in every state?
Right.
I'm doing the big serious report at the Midway landfill, right? The next day, Stevie Wonder is coming to town to start a concert on Wednesday, but Tuesday is doing a sound check. And I know about this because I'm a huge Stevie Wonder fan. And I tell the assignment, hey, we should go to the Stevie Wonder sound check. It's Stevie Wonder. They didn't, what's the relevance? It's fucking Stevie Wonder. That's the relevance, you know?
Yeah.
So I talk him into it, but I have to go to in addition, when I drive up to Seattle, you have to stop by the city council meeting on sludge waste or whatever the hell, you know? So we blow that off. We go over to the Coliseum, which is now the Climate Pledge Arena, right?
Right.
And they tell us, you can only stay for 10 minutes. No interviews. Stay away from the stage. Get your B-roll. Get the hell out. That's what they tell us, right? So we're shooting. They kind of forget that they made the rule that stringent. And a reporter runs up on the stage and starts asking Stevie questions during a break. I see this from the back of the gym, like, get out there. So me and the Tom Hickey was my camera. We go sprinting up there. I'm the last guy in. We were the farthest one back. So we're the last guy on stage. They're talking about world peace or something. I'm so nervous. My hand is shaking. Like, I can't hold my hand still. I just can't, physically can't. And I lay it down to get, you know, to get some stability. It turns out I put it on the keys. So like, he's talking and you hear like, you know, and Stevie just turns the volume to zero. He doesn't get mad. He keeps talking. He knew somebody was fucking up his keyboard.
Wow.
Probably not hurting it really. He didn't give a shit. He just, I got more keyboards.
Wow.
So that happened, right? So we run our
stuff.
Years later, Tim Scanlon was the baseball boss at ESPN. I was always in the softball games with the All-Star break. Mm-hmm. The All-Star game was going to be in Detroit. I think it was 2005 or 06, somewhere in there. All-Star baseball is going to be in Detroit. Stevie's from Detroit, Saginaw. He's playing in a concert in Philadelphia. My vision is I want to go down to Philadelphia, get him to say something funny, and we'll use it in 3 weeks at Detroit because of the affiliation. Tim's like, I think, yeah, go for it. I said, just so you know, like, I have nothing set up. I'm not promising. Yeah, that's fine. Just good luck. Have fun. You'll get it. And I spent 15 hours in Philadelphia. It was the Live 8 concert, if anybody remember. Not Live Aid, but Live 8.
Live 8.
G8 Summit.
Yeah.
And they were trying to influence the G8 nations to relieve African debt. That was the point of the concert thing. And Stevie's the headliner of the Philadelphia. And everybody's there, right? I got the flimsiest press pass you've ever seen. Looked like somebody would hand it out for a grade school, field day. It was that kind of level of a pass, like a just paper, right? And it doesn't get me anything. I'm in a tent about 9 blocks from I'm nowhere near Stevie Wonder. Somehow I luck out. I run into a Teamster who's there setting up barricades or whatever. And he recognizes me from SportsCenter, gives me a lanyard. He had an extra one. So I get closer and closer to Stevie Wonder. I go over to the compound near not far from the set, and I'm trying to like get one of his guys. Just, hey, I'm here from ESPN. I'm trying to do this bit, you know. And his guy keeps waving people in, like Will Smith gets waved in, and then Natalie Portman gets all these famous people are going in to meet Stevie. And he looks straight at me and he's waving, big smile. Come on, you know, like, you're next. And in my head, I'm like, how the fuck do they know who I am? There's no way they know who I am. Okay, that's fourth time he's waved. And I take a half a step forward. Don Cheadle walks by me. Mm. They were waving to him, obviously, right behind me, but he wasn't paying attention. So now I'm a little bummed, but somehow I get lucky and I get to his guy. I tell him the whole bit. He says, I'm not going to ask him, but after the show, when he's done, you stand right here. We're going to come through this alley. I'll bring him to you. You get your shot. Fair enough. I get, you know, I'm going to pitch Stevie Wonder on a line. He comes
incredible.
By.
Incredible.
This is 15 hours deep. And by the way, BET was going to interview Stevie, but their camera broke. Something went down. So in a gesture of goodwill, we took their tape, stuck it in our machine. They interview him. So now we're kind of like in the mix, right?
Wow.
And now it's my turn. We get their tape back to them, put our tape in. This is back when people use tape. And then Stevie Wonder listens to me. I explain that I'm your biggest fan. I work for ESPN, blah, blah, blah. Here's the bit. Can you say, I can't be at the baseball All-Star game. I have a high ankle sprain. He laughed and then he did in one take. Perfect. Like just perfect intonation. Like he owned it. Right. I said, thank you so much. Appreciate it. He walks away. I said, when's that album coming out? And he turns back. He goes, soon. And he keeps walking. It was greatest 2 minutes ever. I then got to interview him like a more legitimate interview, the Super Bowl in Detroit, Seahawks and the Steelers. And I reminded him of that.
Wow.
And he made that joke. I said, so basically, because I laid my mic on your keys, you turned it down. Essentially, we have collaborated. I've told people this. And he's like, let's make the album. Or, you know, he had like a good parting bit on it.
Yeah. The best.
He's something. So yeah, he'd be it. Of all the other ones I did get to do, being at Dale Earnhardt's 500 win and working with him the next year, and a year later after that, I guess it was right
when he crashed.
So yeah, there's 10,000 great little moments like that. But
yeah,
how is Stevie not number one?
That's right, Kenny Mayne. Thank you, buddy. We're going to let you run.
We're just getting started here.
I know.
All right. Walter.
Do you want to see the cat Walter. Again? Wait,
yeah,
Walter.
Yeah, love to.
Hold on.
Walter. Where's Walter? Come on, Walt. There's Walt.
This is our new segment.
Show us your pet.
Walter's shooting dice. Coming out.
Sweetness.
New shooter.
New shooter. New
roll
shooter.
The dice. Walter, roll the dice. Go. Do it. Do it. Show him. Come on. Come on, Walter.
He's camera shy. Oh, there you go. Yeah, just a little nap. Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah, this was good. I didn't know what we talked about. I don't know why we did it, but I'm glad we did.
Thanks,
buddy.
Have
your guy. Text me right now. Give me
your
guy.
I will. Greg Bond will be calling you.
Nice meeting you, buddy. Be well.
Much love.
Awesome.
My main, Kenny Mayne. I told you that before we came on, that for years, even before I met Kenny Mayne, if I saw him on TV, I'd walk into a room and say, my main, Kenny Mayne.
I like it.
And then we became buddies, and I'll send him a text every week or so that says, hey, my main, Kenny Mayne. Or I'll reply to a tweet with, my main, Kenny Mayne. What a guy, yeah. Right?
How about you might have just changed your buddy's life.
Oh, Greg, I'm telling you, he's been down and out. He's been to different surgeons and specialists and whatnot. He had the metal removed. He's done all of it, but he's gotten to the point where it's like, man, I think I may just have to get it fused. And then he's worried about limping and the restriction of movement and all that stuff.
Sure.
And so anyway, yeah, I'm going to put him with Kenny Mayne.
I like that. Gosh. You know what? You know how we did that occasionally? We tried to equate basketball players with actors.
Yes.
You know, we did that. While we talked there, I was like, if you were doing sports announcers, he would be Michael Keaton.
Yeah, good call.
You know, just
good
kind
call.
Of
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Throw that out there.
You just plug him in wherever and he's going to make it work.
And he's awesome.
Awesome.
Every time.
Good call, bud. All right. Hey, you want to do this again next week?
I really would.
Me too. That was Kenny Mayne. Join us here next week for the Rex Chapman Show with my super dope homeboy from the Lextown, Josh Hopkins, powered by basketballnews.com.